since we have people here. So welcome, everyone.
Sure.
There are three of us, Shelley Macy, Maya Coleman, and me, Robin Sechko. We're all hand-in-hand instructors, and we'll introduce ourselves in just a little bit. We're glad you're here for the teleseminar. We're all instructors with Hand in Hand Parenting, which is a nonprofit organization based in Palo Alto, California, in the United States. But there are instructors worldwide working with these tools and these ideas. Hand in Hand is here to support parents and professionals working with parents and families. And we're going to talk specifically today about how do we build the connection for the early childhood education group. And because connection is the focus of Hand in Hand, listening is the basis of all the tools. And we offer articles on the website, many articles, there's classes, there's free podcasts. There's all sorts of material on the website, but we're here because we're all instructors for the Professionals Intensive course that Hand in Hand offers. It's an 8-week course that is available for any professional working with children. And we're glad you're here. Hi there. Go ahead and mute. And thank you. That makes it easier for all of us to hear. So I'll just give you a little outline of what we're going to do today, and then we'll introduce ourselves and get into the sort of the important part of the talk here. So we're each going to do an introduction, and then Shelley's going to talk about the importance of connection in early learning settings, how we bring it throughout sort of a child's day. And then Maya's going to talk about using the tools that are sort of beautifully developed for the healing process for children. I'm going to talk about the tool of listening partnerships and their importance in our lives. We'll have some time for some question and answers, and depending on how much, then that'll be a chance for you to ask anything you've been wondering about. And depending on how long that goes, Maya will talk about information about the current research and findings. Shelley will share some stories from teaching early childhood and early childhood staff, and then we'll have our closing. So, and if you know, you don't get a chance to answer a question today, all of us are available by email after the call, and we, you know, love to stay connected with you. We're all very devoted to these tools and the importance for bringing them into the lives of children as they leave their parents in the morning and spend the day, you know, with people other than their parents. So, as I said, I'm Robin Sechko. I live in Santa Rosa, California, the west coast of the United States, about an hour and a half north of San Francisco. I'm a licensed marriage family therapist, and I have my own practice, and then I also work through Hand in Hand, the certification program, the Professionals Intensive, and I teach in schools and preschools. I work with parents, and I have two grown children who are 28 and 25, and I learned about these tools when they were in elementary school. It was the richest parenting resource I'd ever come across, and it's just been really transformative in my life, and so I love sharing these ideas with people, and we're glad you're here. So, Maya, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hi, everybody. I'm Maya Coleman, and I live in Washington, D.C. with my spouse and our 14-year-old daughter, and we're a multiracial adoptive family. In my work life, I'm a clinical psychologist. I'm in private practice, and I work with families of young children, primarily birth to six. I also have a background in special education, so I do a lot of collaboration with preschools in the area, both to support individual children, but also to help schools move toward more trauma-informed practices. I'm also involved in Hand in Hand's research team, which is developing a plan to evaluate the Hand in Hand tools in many different settings. Right now, we're focusing on supporting early childhood educational community. So I'll talk a little bit more about that at the end. Okay, so Shelley.
Thanks. Thanks, Maya. I'm Shelley Macy, and I live in Bellingham, Washington. And I have been in early childhood education my entire adult life. I'm now retired, but I taught preschool, beginning in Montessori education, and then other things for about 12 and a half years, and then followed that with 27 years at Northwest Indian College on the Lummi Reservation, where I taught early childhood education and parenting ed using hand-in-hand tools, sort of from the beginning of hand-in-hand. So I've worked with so many Head Start teachers, teacher assistants, child care workers, people who do the cooking and the cleaning in early learning programs, bus drivers, family service coordinators, directors, and many, many wonderful people. I love working with early childhood people. It's exciting to me that there's a whole bunch of people showing on my screen, and I expect most of you have some connection to early childhood. And my experience is that we are good folks. We work hard. We're open and willing to try things and enthusiastic, and we love and respect children. So I'm going to talk about connection and the importance of connection and why it's important for early learning, and then what happens when connection breaks. And then Maya will follow with some of the tools of Hand in Hand, both Maya and Robin, for rebuilding connection. So I gotta say that connection is what we do in early learning. We know it's important. We do it all the time. It's a moment-to-moment, all-day-long kind of thing. With our warmth, our eye contact, our ability to listen to little ones, decipher what they're saying, the respect that we have and the way we reach for them to gain their trust and their cooperation and their respect back. It is so important to everything else we do. Why? Well, we know it. It's just vital to children. And it's as important as eating and sleeping for the health and well-being of little ones. As we know, and the research has shown, that the early years is when the most tremendous rate of learning goes on for human beings. And it is precisely the connection with parents and other caring adults like us that allows the neural pathways to grow in their brains in this tremendous rate that'll never be as great as in these early years. So I want to talk just a little bit about the brain and kind of to give this a little bit of context. If you were to hold your hand up in a fist and put your thumb in on your palm and wrap the fingers down around your thumb, this can be our little model of the brain. And the thumb, tucked inside, represents the limbic system, the part of the brain that is wired to reach for and engage in steady communication with people around us. And this part of the brain is working extraordinarily well from birth. It's not something we have to learn to use. It's working. And it's that part of the brain that reads the nonverbal signals of the adults around us and the love and the caring that's coming in, or the overwork and the irritation or the frustration or the connection that people are reaching for us with. The limbic system is where emotions are felt, where our gut reactions to things are. Babies are immediately looking for connection and for safety, and it's where we're able to assess safety just from the signals we're getting. And also, it's where long-term memory sits. So this part of the brain is extraordinarily important. And connection is what gives the child's limbic system and the brain the signal that it's safe to learn and grow. So every positive response that you give, the smile on your face when a child walks in the room, even if they're the kid that kind of makes you grit your teeth, or the way you help a little toddler climb up that foam block saying, I think you can do it, and they try. Every little thing you do helps children to feel connected, to thrive, and to be able to think and grow. So the part of your hand that's covering your thumb, that biggest part, is representing in this model the prefrontal cortex, which is the largest part of the human brain. And it is extraordinarily important. It is the seat of judgment, planning, paying attention, the ability to reason, to control impulses, to cooperate, and to learn, to put things into short-term memory so you can learn them, like learning that there's a one-to-one correspondence. Everybody gets a plate at the table, and every plate gets a fork, and those kinds of things that children are learning and growing. All of these things are the things we talk about as self-regulation, impulse control, planning, reasoning. They all occur in this marvelous prefrontal cortex, huge part of the brain. Well, the limbic system allows all parts of the brain to work smoothly together. So when the limbic system is bathed in connection, the prefrontal cortex happily works well. And what this looks like is that when we are connecting well with a child and they can tell we like them and they like us, that they are really eager to cooperate, to self-regulate, to try things that we suggest, to work with the other children and to share and cooperate. Okay. But we live in a society, children aren't always feeling connected. And we live in a society that, in fact, makes it kind of hard at times. We're under-resourced as parents. We're under-resourced as early childhood workers. And we have more to do than we have time for, and sometimes energy or attention for. And so connection breaks, and we can't prevent it. I mean, even if things were perfect, there would be things that would happen that falling down makes a child feel disconnected from their ability to balance. But small and big things happen. Friends break, parents are deployed or incarcerated, a grandparent moves away or dies. So lots of things happen. But what happens when connection breaks is that children feel hurt, and they immediately look for a way to reconnect. Because they can't think, they can't be reasonable, they can't pay attention to other things. What they need right now is to reconnect and heal the hurt that caused the disconnection. Unable to do that, and we aren't always able to give them that chance, and we aren't always there when it happens. Lots of things happen. What will happen instead if they cannot heal that hurt and reconnect is that their behavior will show us that they're feeling disconnection. Their thinker isn't thinking, and their behavior goes off track. And this is a wonderful perspective on children's behavior. It's just having this perspective. If all you do with hand in hand is say, yes, that's what I thought. This is a good perspective. This will be a useful, I will have done my job. What happens when they feel disconnected is it's like an emotional emergency. They have to get reconnected. And if you think about it, human children could not survive without adults to take care of them. So they're born with way too much learning to do. Their heads are too big to stay in long enough to be able to take care of themselves. So they come out and they have to have someone taking care of them. If they don't feel connected, the behavior shows. It's where you see hitting or biting, pulling hair happen. Children will signal that they're feeling disconnected by throwing a block or looking at you with that sweet grin or that innocent look and then doing the exact opposite thing of what you told them to do. Or maybe it's refusing to get on the bus or off the bus at the end of the day, or they won't buckle up in the van, or a child will withdraw, climbing their cubby, sucking their thumb, or fondling their blankie and not come out for any of the wonderful things you've planned. They can't share with their best friend, or they can't settle to do anything. They're just always moving around, and not a single thing will hold their attention more than a moment. Or maybe it's lunchtime and they won't eat anything but hot dogs and chicken nuggets. Or they can't settle at naps. These and all the myriad other behaviors that are familiar to all of us who work in early learning are signals that children feel disconnected. So connection is vital to children. Behavior goes off track when they feel disconnected. And every single person in an early learning program is vital to the connection that children feel. Parents, bus drivers, cooks, TAs, maintenance staff, the director, the substitute teachers. Oh, who did I forget? The teachers. Everybody plays a role in building connection with children, and in that way makes a big difference in their ability to learn and grow. Because children, you know, don't automatically connect with the person who's the certified teacher or the mental health professional. We need those resources in our programs, but sometimes it's you. You're the one. You're the one greeting the child who's at the doorway, or you're the one cleaning up the mess in the on the floor, and suddenly they show you their difficulty. They get mad or upset or show their disappointment or grief and strike out for no reason. Any one person with this perspective and the tools that Maya is now going to talk about can make a very big difference in an early learning program. And it was amazing to me when I got to teach, I had a research project I did in 2014 and got to teach all of the staff in our little early learning program on campus these tools, hand-in-hand tools for helping children reconnect. And what a wonderful, wonderful difference that made. So I want to emphasize that bringing in the whole village of early childhood, all of the teachers and all of the staff and the parents, is essential to children's well-being and their sense of connection. And we're essential. Every one of us matters. And Maya is now going to talk about rebuilding connection when it breaks. So thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to it.
Thanks so much, Shelley. So great to hear. Good. So what I would like to do is sort of help you visualize what it can look like when lots of different members of an educational community actually bring the hand-in-hand connection-building tools into their relationships kind of throughout the community. And I think it can be challenging to imagine what this looks like, kind of given the constraints of, you know, a school or a daycare program. Sort of, you know, we think about the ratio of adults to children, kind of, you know, limiting times that those relationships can be built. There's always a lot going on, lots of people having needs, having feelings, lots of things that need to get done, and often, you know, with pretty limited resources. So I think, like, the most important thing to keep in mind as you're listening to the stories that Shelley will be sharing, is that we're really looking to set up a culture of connection in addition to strengthening individual relationships, and that this actually can be created in the little moments of time that we might have. So when I work with teachers or administrators and staff, I'm always looking to identify small critical moments. So, you know, 1 minute, 2 minutes, sometimes maximum of 3 minutes. We just don't have, you know, huge chunks of time in a school setting often. So we're really looking at moments of transition. So when a child's connection with their teacher can, you know, be hard to feel and behavior tends to go off track, or moments of conflict between students where, where we can make a little bit of room to have the emotion that's happening there, where some emotional anchoring can happen, and keeping an eye out for just some short proactive moments where little one-on-one connections can be made. So just think about that as you're hearing kind of the stories of what this looks like in communities. We're really looking for these kind of short, really potent, critical moments where we can bring some really effective and efficient kind of connection tools. So I think it could be helpful to actually have a really concrete picture in mind of a situation that's really common, that you've probably seen lots of times, in your school or daycare, where we can actually see the process of how people heal from difficult things happening. It's like we see this frequently every day, but we may not always know what we're seeing there. So think about, just imagine, a preschool class heading out for outside time, and people are running on the playground, and two children are kind of running together towards the swings, and one of them trips over something and falls and, bonks their knee. So this is a surprising, potentially scary, kind of hurtful event. And think about what actually happens the very first thing for that child who fell. The first thing they do is they look around to find their person, like the teacher who's out on the playground, who's, keeping track of everybody. They need to make contact with their person. Usually, they're making eye contact. They're getting that person's attention. So ideally, what happens is then, their person sees what happened or sees they're in distress, comes over, brings themselves closer to provide help. And it's actually usually then that's when the child starts to cry. But they need that connection, that support, and that safety to actually have the emotional response to what happened there. So if the bonk is pretty minor and, the adult is coming over, providing some, physical closeness, checking in, just some attention, what you might notice is actually that the child's crying may actually get more intense. So now that the adult is there and paying attention, it can sometimes seem like it escalates there. And this is sometimes when people start to think, oh, I'm, making it worse, or the attention is, making them, get overly upset about something that's kind of minor. So this is often when, we move into kind of soothing, or, you're all right, let's dust you off. We're going to, move your attention somewhere else. We might offer kind of self-regulatory strategies, like let's take some, deep breaths, that kind of thing. But if you don't get busy sort of doing that and kind of trying to regulate things, you actually get to see one of the inborn healing processes that we all have. So the crying that's happening is actually how that child offloads the fear, the tension, the jolt to their system from
Maya, we lost you. No, there you go, Maya.
We're
back.
Okay. Yeah, sorry about that. I don't know what, I got muted externally, it sounded like. So what I was talking about is actually the crying process and sort of seeing seeing what's happening there. Well, the child is crying. So that's actually where they're offloading the tension from the fall, and they're resetting their emergency response system. So if you actually stay and you continue paying attention and you're supporting and you're kind of offering basic support there, you will see this child go through kind of this arc of emotion. And this is where you're actually using one of the hand-in-hand tools, the tool we call Stay Listening, which is providing kind of emotional anchoring and co-regulation during high emotion. So that's where you are creating the conditions and the attention and the safety for this inborn process to actually work. So you're actually doing fewer things than you might typically do during that time, but you're really anchoring and providing co-regulation for that healing process to happen. So as part of this process, you may also need to set some limits on a child's behavior here too. So for example, say, you know, the friend they were running with comes over to see what happened. You know, that child is in an emergency response. So they might actually lash out and hit their friend because they've moved into kind of the fight of, you know, fight, flight, freeze response. So what you would do here is, you know, to set a limit to keep everyone safe while that child is kind of in emergency response mode. So, you know, you might say, whoops, can't let you hit your friend here. I'm just going to keep us safe. You might place your hand on their arm. And this is a situation where you might be tempted to do sort of a lot of other things, like, you know, prompt them to use their words. You might, you know, remind them hands aren't for hitting. You know, you might bring in consequences or rewards. But what we really suggest is to set limits and in a way that keeps everybody safe there, and allows for more room for having those emotions and recognizing that child is in an emergency response and their, you know, frontal lobes are offline, the language center is offline there. We're really communicating with their limbic system, and we want to bring safety and co-regulation to that setting. So that's where we're kind of using, that's one of the places where we might be using our sort of setting limits tool that is a little bit different from, you know, other ways of managing behavior that we might use. So what you will notice as that child kind of has this arc of emotion and is being kept safe, they come down the other side of this big cry, and you may notice that they become, you know, more physically relaxed. They might, you know, lean into the teacher. What they've done is they've borrowed that adult's well-functioning limbic system to co-regulate with. And then what they might start to do is sort of look around and start to cognitively process what happened. So they can start to make use of the information from that experience when they're not having this emotional emergency. So they can sort of think, reflect on what happened, you know, oh, we were running together, we were, you know, running kind of close, I tripped over that route, you know, next time, you know, we can walk to the swings or take a different route, or, you know, they're actually perceiving and processing what happened there, separate from the emotional emergency. And then you may notice that, you know, they just notice something fun happening on the playground. They just run off and join their friends. And that's what that looks like when when that scary moment has been processed, metabolized by their system, and has moved out, it doesn't leave a residue. They're able to just run off and sort of do the next thing. The thing to think about, though, is if they don't get to do this, if we don't get to have this arc of, you know, this natural reset process. So, for example, maybe the teacher doesn't notice, or there isn't really a person, you know, who's keeping track of them, or something else is happening, and they sort of have to, you know, pull themselves together and kind of move on to the next thing. And this, you know, this happens frequently. There's not always, you know, the time, the people, the place, you know, to have this nice, you know, clear arc. But what happens is that that experience has left a residue in their system. So, like, maybe the next day they head out to play, and, you know, all the sights and sounds of, you know, kids running sort of trigger off that memory, and all those feelings come back up. You know, they might feel nervous or uncertain, or you know, they cling to the teacher. They're not just, you know, running off to explore, or, you know, they have outsized reactions to little things, like, you know, their friend runs by them, brushes up against them, and they feel threatened. They're back in a threat response, and they may lash out and hit. What's happening is they're perceiving kind of the current safe situation through the lens of this earlier experience. So, like, that's what the residue of all kinds of difficult experiences looks like, whether it's, you know, a small fall like this, or a bigger upset, you know, a trauma, a small trauma, a big trauma. It's like that's the residue in the system. And, you know, we often see that in classrooms, that children are functioning with lots of residue around different things that get triggered off and lead to big outsized reactions. And that's a lot what, you know, teachers are coping with in schools, is lots of sort of stored emotion. But what's really lucky is that as human beings, we're built to heal from these things that happen. And, you know, that child's system is constantly keeping an eye out for, you know, when there is a person that they can connect with to offload that tension. So this is why, like, the parent comes to pick the child up at the end of the day, and they immediately start to cry, and kind of, you know, they're talking about what happened on the playground, or they're immediately back in that feeling. And that's actually what's happening. They've found their person, that relationship that they can connect in with, and then they initiate this healing process. What the hand-in-hand tools really do is try and set up the conditions for these inborn processes to happen. So some of the proactive tools are focused on building connections between children and their people at school, whether that's the teacher or the bus driver, or, you know, they have their person in different ways throughout the community. So we're strengthening that connection. We're helping those people provide some of these kinds of sort of safe containers and places to listen to some of the feelings, so that children cannot be carrying around so many tensions that get, you know, triggered off throughout the day. We talk about another one of the hand-in-hand tools. We actually call this play listening, where children are trying to access another one of the healing processes, which involves laughter. So it's a similar sort of inborn healing process, like having a big cry or having a big tantrum, actually having a big sort of belly laugh is another way that children offload tension and kind of reset their emergency response. So what you might see is, you know, children trying to access that healing process, you know, related to a trip and fall. So maybe the teacher's walking across the room and, you know, and they trip lightly over the rug, and then some children start giggling there. Like, that's an attempt for those children's system to offload the embarrassment, the uncertainty of, you know, times when they had, you know, experiences like that or felt uncertain or were embarrassed. So, so we actually help people in keeping an eye out for these times where you can promote that kind of laughter. We call it play listening. And what the teacher might do is actually just do a little bit more of that. Just follow what helps children laugh in that situation. And this is a sort of it's a different way of sort of seeing laughter. Often that kind of laughter gets interpreted as you know, off-track behavior or dysregulation or being disrespectful, or, you know, it doesn't always work within a classroom setting. But when we help teachers kind of understand what's happening with that sort of laughter process, sometimes you can just bring in and make room for, you know, 2 to 3 minutes of a little more laughter like that.
Maya, my dear, we're going to need to give Robin a chance to talk about the listening partnership. So tie it up.
Yes, that's great. Perfect timing. Yep, I was just going to transition to those are some examples of just using the tools. And Shelley's going to talk a little bit more about what listening partnerships look like within the community.
Actually, Robin's going to.
Yeah. Thanks, Maya. Robin. I love listening to both of you. So wonderful. I'm going to talk about the tool of listening partnerships, which is an exchange of time, support, listening with one other person. And this might be in person. It might be on phone, over Skype, WhatsApp, and really having the opportunity to be listened to sort of be outraged or something, or to cry, to have someone tend to our feelings is really crucial on a regular basis, to be able to be that person who can move in to close to a child who's just done something, you know, like bit another child or hit another child, you know, to be that person who moves in and anchors. And this is the tool that will really allow you to follow through with all the other tools, because the work that you're doing is very demanding emotionally, physically, and in order to keep doing that on sort of a minute by minute basis, we need to really be supported deeply. And so listening partnership is the tool for that. So you might be listening to parents, you might be listening to your staff, you might be listening to children. And all of this, you know, working with children, it's going to bring up a lot of feelings for us. So again, we've got this whole parallel process going of maybe upsets that come up in us when children do things, or the exhaustion or sort of the isolation of working with a whole group of children, that we get to take to somebody who cares deeply about what we're saying and says, I want to hear everything. And you get to notice what makes it safe for me to share this with this person. So this is, you know, maybe a peer, maybe someone in your life, and that hand in hand, we're really committed to you building the kind of support you need to be the teacher, the director, the parent that you want to be, knowing that this is
really hard work on a daily basis. So, because our mind can go to some awful places, and we need to tell someone when we've been hijacked, when we're upset, when we feel like we just can't go on, because your listening partner is going to care. They're not going to give you advice. They're not going to solve it for you. They're not going to worry about you not knowing what to do, because that's the state we're in often with children, is just sort of unsure how to move forward. And as Maya was saying, for us to move into that child on the playground, you know, with the kind of presence and anchoring, it takes a lot on our part. And so we want to be sure that you're getting the support that you need. So in this process, there's, you know, a lot of information on the website, certainly in the professionals intensive that we'll all be leading. We'll go into much more depth about how would you set up a listening partnership? How might you set this up even in your center with other staff, if that's something that you want to do. I won't go into all the details right here, but there's a lot of information available for how to make these listening partnerships sort of a regular process in your life. Because a lot gets stirred up for us in these moments. And the attachment research says that really the best possible thing we can do as teachers, as parents, is to really know our own personal narrative well, to have integrated it, to have talked about it, to understand its impact on us. And so we're working on it, and then we don't ever direct it to the children. And I've had the experience of raising my children partly before I had listening partnerships, and then learning about listening partnerships, and they've made an enormous difference in my life. So that's one of the things that Hand in Hand has given me, is really that opportunity to talk about maybe how scared I feel, how guilty I feel, how confused I feel, how all those feelings that all of us as professionals and parents feel, a place where somebody is appreciating me, remembering I'm good, while I'm saying the places that where I just feel, you know, completely lost. And so, because just as with the children, you know, there's experiences we've had that have overwhelmed us, that have disturbed us, and they might be big traumas or they might be small, just as with the children. And these experiences, they're actually held in the brain in a different way than experiences that aren't overwhelming or just ordinary or readily understood. And the way that these painful or frightening or overwhelming experiences can become integrated is to have a supportive person listening to us all the way through, till we can think again, till we can begin to integrate this. And you'll notice here, this is exactly what we're doing for the children. Because these experiences actually, they get separated from our full awareness. And until, you know, and sometimes the way we'll know about them is that the feeling just comes roaring up. It's fast, it's hot, you know, it's sort of like, wow. Because there are explicit memories where we might, you know about it. And there are also implicit memories that might live in our unconscious. Memories that we don't remember. And so a child may do something and we have an enormous reaction and we just think, wow. And so that's something we can take to our listening partner. And again, we can become aware of those because of how they sort of flare for us, because memories demand attention and memories have teeth. And so what the listening partnership is for is a place to actually work on those. And it truly has the potential for personal transformation through this deep support, because having a caring listener or many caring listeners finding your person or your person, people with whom you feel safe and seen and heard. It's really the best resource for you as you're doing this work closely with children. And all these tools, really, they're not sustainable without the tool of listening partnership. Because when a connection, many traumas actually happen within a relationship. So when a limbic connection has established a neural pattern, it takes a limbic connection to revive it. So a listener is there to hear your experience just as it is. And then your listener might counter it step by miniature step. And then, we can actually change one another's brains through this limbic resonance, much as Maya was talking about with the children. But your listening partner says, thank you for telling me. Here's your strength that I see. Here's the bigger picture I see. I'm pleased to be here with you. You're good through and through. And I want to hear everything. That's what a listening partner is going to bring to you. That's what you're going to bring to your listening partnerships on a regular basis. And sort of slowly, this process of painful, confusing, frightening, overwhelming incidents can become understandable or integrated, after a supportive person has listened all the way through. Until you feel whole again. This process works over time. We repair the damage, the hurt, the pain left by difficult experiences, maybe today or maybe from long ago. And, each time a difficult memory is evoked, and you're the best to know what those are because, you'll get that feeling inside. Each time it's evoked and it's met with the attention of a confident listener, it changes. And that experience of comfort, understanding, and the presence of a connected other, it gets added to that experience and it goes back into long-term storage changed. And that's the beauty of listening partnerships. That's the beauty of understanding this process for ourselves. Because it just takes lots of repetition, and over time you'll be less reactive, things will be less intense when you're under stress. And then you've got more capacity to relax, play, and be present with your children that you work with. And it really transforms the limbic part of the brain that Shelley was talking about. It changes our emotional landscape forever. And personally, having a number of listening partnerships as my children went through adolescence, and I brought all sorts of feelings and sort of reactions and memories of growing up as the middle child of five, very close in age, five teens in my family all at once. To be able to meet my adolescents, our two children, in a different way. So, and as we change our lives, our children change, our community changes, and we can really change the course of the world, which is why all three of us are so committed to these tools and to, what difference we can make in the world. And we're happy that you're here to join us in that. It's my belief that what we do inside relationships matters more than almost anything. And that setting up a listening partnership to be able to pour out our feelings that shame us or overwhelm us or, to be able to cry and therefore not target children or our partners with these feelings, it can make a huge difference. And is this limbic regulation and it helps the children. So I'll stop there and we'll move into question and answers. We'd like to hear from you. Any comments you want to make or questions that have come up for you as we're talking here.
And I assume, I'm not sure how hand raising happens, if you know, Maya or Shelley. Maybe just unmute and speak out if you'd like to.
You just have to unmute yourself. It says push the star key twice or touch the, if you're on your computer, you can touch the little microphone on your screen.
Okay.
See what happens. I'm not entirely confident that's how it works, but. Huh.
Anyone have anything?
Yes, if you touch the star key twice and pause, it should unmute you.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, okay. It seems like the teachers at my child's school, or I guess in general, they're more receptive to this type of thing when they're younger, but then they feel like when the children are in the older elementary grades, it doesn't apply in the same way. And they don't, they're not familiar with the entire hand-in-hand program, but when I try and introduce concepts just in conversation or with my daughter's caregivers, who do also teach at school, so like they feel like she's in special ed, so some of them feel like, oh, well, special ed kids have special, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, they're more lenient, but then the neurotypical kids, well, they, you know, at this point, they need to do certain things, and they don't see it in the same way as they would with a smaller child. Does that make sense?
Yeah. This is Shelley. And what I would say is that the tools for setting for play listening and special time, I'm not sure what you've tried to convey, and I congratulate you for trying. teachers really do want things that work. Child care providers really want stuff that will work and to help turn things around for kids. And once they're in grade school age, the children accumulate more backlog of disconnection and a sense that nobody's really there. And so figuring out they're not as easy to reach in some ways. And I like to point people at various articles on our Hand in Hand website that would list any particular specific behaviors or working how to communicate these ideas to someone who's not on the same page with you yet can be really, really helpful. And I don't know if you've been able to access those, but boy, it's like every behavior, I have this concept in mind about connection and disconnection and limbic system and say listening, but a particular behavior that I can't think about because I would have gotten in so much trouble if I'd done that, it has really helped to read something there and on the Hand in Hand website and communicating with people who are not on the same page. I love that article.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. Other questions?
Hello.
Well, my idea. Oh, go ahead.
Hi. Can you repeat the name of the article that you were just talking about, please?
I'll try looking it up while we're online.
Okay.
Get back to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what
Maya, do you want to go ahead? Oh, good. Go ahead.
Yes. So what I was going to say is that echoing with the other person was saying is that, you know, I've been a teacher for 25 years, and every day I learn something new, and I am the type of person that likes to learn to bring to the children things that I think that, you know, will help them with their feelings, and to show more feelings, because there's a lot of children that don't know how to show their feelings because they have been shushed. And so when that happens, they don't know how to do it. And so I feel that my role is to let them know that in my place, this is a safe place where they can show me all these feelings, and then that I'm here to listen. But the other thing is that what I do is that I also let parents, families know my philosophy. At the beginning of the year, I give this small workshop of how I work with the kids in this area. And so that way, and I also try to give them like handouts or send them messages from hand in hand to read. So they know that this is the kind of work that I do in the classroom. To kind of be in the same, you know, and, you know, because not every family is going to be doing what we do and what we want to do with our kids.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, great. And where are you located?
I'm in Oakland, California.
Okay, great. Thanks.
I'm sorry. I just wanted the name of the article that I guess I didn't catch up with that article,
sure.
And I'm really very interested in that.
The article is, well, I found one of them. There's more than one, but this one is called Parenting from Different Pages. So it's about, like, if you and your partner parent differently and trying to convey these tools. And I want to highlight that one piece of it is the listening partnership for yourself with someone who's not the daycare teacher or the teacher that you're trying to convey these ideas can really help, because we all went to school and we've all had situations happen where we felt like they didn't understand us in school. And if we can have a place to vent those feelings with someone else and then see this teacher as someone different than the teacher who could not listen to us or whatever, the listening partnership is really a valuable tool to use over and over in order to keep going and persisting with the very important project of reaching an educational professional. But anyway, the article Parenting from Different Pages is one of them. And then another one that I think is useful is Parenting Across Social, Racial, and Economic. And again, these are parenting, but I think the ideas are really useful in thinking about professionals.
Thanks.
I had a follow-up
question. Go ahead.
Sorry, I didn't know if I was still on or not. I just had a quick question, and maybe you addressed this. Is there a summary of the, for lack of a better word, experiment that was done at the school for the early childhood education using hand in hand?
Yeah, that's exactly what Maya was going to do now.
Oh,
thank you.
yeah, I can talk about that super quickly. Yeah, so what we did, what our research team did, was we were taking a look at the introductory class that we offer to parents and the class that we offer to professionals. So we've had early childhood educators participate in the introductory class for parents, the introductory class for professionals, and we really wanted to adapt the course to be very, very useful, specifically in early childhood educational communities. So what we did is did some modifications to the 6-week introductory course, which is 6 weeks of online readings and videos, along with a weekly mentoring call led by a hand-in-hand instructor who meets with 3 or 4 other, you know, educators and provides mentoring each week. So we took a look at that class, and we enrolled teachers from an inclusion preschool here in Washington, D.C., the National Child Research Center, and teachers from Head Start programs in southern New Hampshire. So we took them through the 6-week course. We got weekly questionnaires about the course itself, about the tools. We had 60 to 90 minute exit interviews with everybody immediately after the class ended, and we're now doing a follow-up 3 months later to see what impact this has had on those teachers. So we're doing those interviews in March. We've looked at the quantitative data in terms of the interviews, in terms of the questionnaires, and then we're going to look at the qualitative data in terms of the interviews and all of that. So, we are hoping to actually, write a manuscript and have that published, and we're preparing to revise that course, given all of the really great feedback we got from people. People found it super, super helpful and gave us really specific recommendations for how to make it even more useful for early childhood educators. So we're in the process of revising that, and we're looking to set up a pilot study where we're enrolling lots of different people from different kinds of programs to go through the newly designed course and to look at sort of outcome measures and what happens in people's classrooms who are who are using these tools. So that's where we're at. We have mentorship and some funding from Harvard Center on the Developing Child to design this research plan, to conduct this study, and we're looking to secure funding for the pilot study, and hopefully we'll continue to be working with them. So there is nothing sort of written up in terms of the outcome of the study yet, but we're working on that, and so definitely keep an ear out. We'll be posting things on the website and hopefully sending things out through the email listserv to let people know about opportunities to kind of be involved with the research, maybe to participate in the pilot study.
Thanks. Shelley, do you want to give a few stories?
It's noon here in Washington State. I think we need to, I would love to tell stories, but I think we need to let people know what's available for the professionals intensive and online and hand-in-hand and other resources, and then bid one another farewell for now. Robin, you want to do that? Robin?
Yes, absolutely. And I'll tell what's available. People can hop off if they need to. And then, we can take 5 more minutes if that's fine with me. Maya, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, that'd be great.
So starting April 6th, there will be 4 different professional intensive courses offered. That's an 8-week course. You'll be on the call with probably 3 or 4 others. various professions. We love having people in the early childhood development field come on the call, the calls each week. So you can sign up for that online. As Shelley said, there's many articles. and we hope you'll stay connected with Hand in Hand. And glad you're here. You're welcome to stay, as Shelley says, shares a few stories. But if you want to, if you need to hop off, then we understand also.
Okay, thanks, Robin. Well, I just want to tell a couple of stories of using Stay Listening in early learning programs and play listening and setting limits. So I'll tell a story, and then if you have a question or anything. I was teaching in a parent co-op preschool many years ago, and we had a new little guy. He was new to the program, and a lot of the families knew each other quite well, and he was a very young three-year-old. These are 3 and 4 year olds. And we had this climber, indoor climber. I love large motor stuff indoors. And so one of our rooms was a playroom with mats on the floor and an indoor climber. And he really wanted to play with the other kids. And I do not have rules about not climbing up the slide. I think climbing up slides where it's safe is a wonderful physical development thing that can result in lots of fun play and cooperation. But he was not really doing that. He was just sort of laying across the slide, and nobody could do anything, go up or down. And so I said, I tried to engage with him, get on the floor, connect with him, and he just wasn't going to do anything but lay across this slide. So I decided to set a limit. And I'll call him Ben. I don't actually remember his name. I said, Ben, I'm going to have you come and sit with me and watch so you can see the other kids slide, because it's not working for you to be on it this way. So I took him and I held him on my lap. I was sitting down on the mat, and I set the limit, and I just kind of held him gently. And he began to release feelings, but it surprised me, because what he did was he laughed. He just sat on my lap, leaned back, and he would just chuckle and laugh and some belly laugh. And his eyes just started to get more interested in things instead of just sort of being kind of glazed over laying on the slide. And I thought, okay, after he laughed for a while and cuddled with me, and he wasn't very verbal, so we didn't really talk much. I said, you ready to go play? And he said, yeah. And he went and he climbed on the climber and actually engaged with one or two children. He wasn't very skilled at engaging. So that was really cool. I thought, oh, cool. So a few days later, he was doing a similar thing, laying across the slide. And this time I did the similar thing. Ben, I need you to come either go up or down. And he didn't. So I said, well, I'm going to have you sit with me and be my partner for a little while. And this time I took him on my lap, and he burst into tears, and he cried hard for, actually it was a very short time. I was able to observe the other children while he was on my lap. It wasn't hard. It's interesting, because I noticed that when children are crying, the other children will notice if they're okay. And mostly if I'm relaxed and paying attention, they're not worried. Ben's getting what he needs. So he cried hard and for 5 or 7 minutes or something, and then he was done, and I helped him blow his nose, and then he got up and he started to play, and this time he really made connections with other kids. It from that time on, he was able to play with other kids and started building friendships with them and became really a part of the fabric of the whole school. And I was so pleased and so impressed, really, with the internal work that he did in releasing those feelings and being able to figure out how to. I love the way you talked about the arc of the emotions, Maya. They went up and then down and then off he went and made friends. That's one of my favorite stories.
Yeah. Thanks. Okay.
Any questions?
Well, thank you. Yeah. Good.
Any last questions? I do want to say one thing about when I was teaching teachers, I would, one of my practicum courses was to set up times where each child got special time. And we didn't talk about that. That's one of the other of the four listening tools with children. And they would feel like it would be impossible to give one child your undivided attention for any length of time. But I had a first grade teacher in my group once, and I just encouraged people to figure out what's going to work in your program. When do you have free choice? There are lots of things set up for kids to do so they can get involved in that. And you can spend, maybe it's only 2 or 3 or 5 minutes, saying to a child, I'll do whatever you want to do. And really front loading them with connection. It's tremendous help with children who are kind of chronically unconnected. Anyway, she figured out what she would do is each day she would have a child come and eat lunch in the classroom with her. They'd eat lunch together, and then she would give them 5 minutes of special time to do, and she'd say, I'll play whatever you want. And she said, should I give them options? Because I don't want them doing inappropriate things. And I said, well, if it's just you and them, why don't you see what happens if you just say, I'll do whatever you want to do. She was a little trepidatious, but she decided to try it. And they got their lunch trays and came into her classroom and ate lunch together. And she said, I learned so much about those children in that eating lunch. It only takes 10 minutes to eat lunch. And they would talk about things, just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. And then she'd say, okay, I'll do whatever you want to do for 5 minutes. And not a single child chose anything inappropriate. They all chose something that was wonderful for them, and she just paid attention and did follow their lead in the play. And then they would go outside. And first she was going to just work with this one child who was really struggling in the classroom, behavior off track all the time. But the child, as they left the first day, she said, now you're going to do this with all the other kids, right? You know, it gives me a lump in my throat. The thoughtfulness of that child, she understood something very profound happened, and she wanted it for all her friends. So she tweaked it a little bit. She closed the blinds that came into her classroom so the children weren't all peering in the room. And she got through all, she had a very small class. I think she had 9 or 11 children. This was at the tribal school. And she got through all of them, and then they were all completely patient because they knew their turn would come, and they knew they just loved it. And this was like 7 years ago, and I see her at the tribal school, and she says, Shelly, you changed my life. And I'm like, you did it, you and the kids. But yeah, I gave you some tools to try, and it was wonderful. It is wonderful. Okay.
Oh, thanks. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for being here and for staying over. Again, we'll have the Professionals Intensive starting in April 6th. Peruse the website for more articles, and do stay in touch.
Yes, thank you all so much for joining us.
Yes.